The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. I'll be your host for the Book Nook coming up following NPR News, and this morning a debut novel from a woman named Janet Ellis. It's called The Butcher's Hook. We're going to join her by telephone in London, England. And Janet is quite well known in England and the United Kingdom, but I had never heard of her until I found this wonderful book and read it and said, I've got to talk to Janet Ellis about this compelling new novel set in Georgian England. It's called The Butcher's Hook. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Janet Ellis. She has just published a book called The Butcher's Hook, and she joins us by telephone from London, England. Hello, Janet.
Hi, Vic. How nice to talk to you.
Janet, this is your first book.
It is.
What happened? What made you decide to write a book?
Well, as you can see, it's a long story. I'd always wanted to be an actress when I was little. That's all I ever said I wanted to be, long before, actually, I think I knew what it meant. But I'd always loved stories. I don't think the two are miles apart. And I became an actress. I went to the Royal Central School. In fact, I was in the same year as Carrie Fisher when she was at drama school in England. And everything I'd done at school was geared towards going to drama school and becoming an actress. But at the back of my mind was always this notion that one thing I loved was reading, and I loved writing as well, but not with a view to publication, just because I often wanted to make sense of the world by keeping a diary or writing about what I was seeing. And the older I got, the more it became this real ambition at the back of my mind. But equally, the longer it went on, the more nervous I got about actually saying to people, this is what I want to do. Because in my professional life, I've done a lot of things which are, I don't know, they're pretty silly. Huge fun. I wouldn't take any of it back, but pretty silly. But writing was a serious thought in my mind. And I just felt very nervous about saying to somebody, this is what I want to do, and them saying, that's great, but it's not very good, so don't bother. So I just put a lot of obstacles and barriers in my way until I finally got to the end of all those excuses and thought, it's what I want to do most in the world, and I have to. It's now or never.
Janet, I received a copy of the book from your American publisher, and I looked at it, and I thought, Janet Ellis, The Butcher's Hook. And I liked the cover, and then I looked at the back, and it said, beautifully crafted, Janet Ellis is a masterful storyteller, and it was Claire McIntosh that had given you this blurb, and I just had Claire on the other day. Her new book it's not out yet in the U.S., but we taped a pre-interview with her, and I thanked her. I said, Claire, thank you so much, because you gave that blurb to Janet, and I might not have cracked this book open, except I thought,
wow,
Claire McIntosh liked it, and then I looked you up, and I thought, I'm just ignorant. Janet Ellis is actually very famous. You're a famous person in England, aren't you?
Well, it's a sort of, oh yes, fame. The program that I presented in the 80s called Blue Peter is a children's magazine program. It had been already on air 25 years before I joined, and it's still on air now. It's a British institution. It's one of those things that if you are born and raised here, you don't have to explain to people. They absolutely understand it. Mm. It used to be on twice a week when I was there. I think I'm right in saying it's once a week now. Obviously, I don't have children young enough to watch it. And my grandchildren are actually not quite the right age for it either. But it is a British institution. And it's one of those things where even if you weren't a child in the 80s and knew that I was your presenter then, when you explain to people, Janet, oh, yeah, she was on Blue Peter, they kind of go, oh, yes. They know what it is immediately. So it has a place in British hearts, and I can't tell you how happy I am to have been part of that. It's a joyful part of my life. It was absolutely a lovely thing to do. So, yes, I do have that kind of, once you've explained it, people get who I was. And my eldest child, I've got three kids, but my eldest is a pop singer here, and she is really successful. So if you weren't going to go, oh, yes, after you'd had the Blue Peter part of my fame explained to you, then when they say Sophie Ellis Bextor, people go, oh, yes, and they get a double helping. By a process of elimination, people get to some part of what I've been doing with my life. But I can't tell you how lovely it is. That the great thing, you know, I've had these several fairly unplanned careers, which I've really enjoyed. And then publishing was an unknown quantity for me. I didn't know what to expect from the world of publishing. I've got some friends who are writers, but that doesn't mean I had much idea of what was going to happen. And it's the loveliest, kindest world, and it is full of people like Claire. I thought they would think, having got to my advanced stage and having done several other things before, that they'd kind of go, I don't know what makes you think you can have a go at publishing a book. But people like Claire came straight up and said, I love it that you're here. Welcome. And it's just been utterly thrilling. And now the great joy is that I'm already at the stage, having had a book published, where I get sent novels by first-time writers, and I can pay it forward. It's joyful.
Claire told me she doesn't usually read historical novels, but she read yours, and she loved it, and I loved it. And before we skip past your daughter, didn't she have a big hit with Murder on the Dance Floor? Okay.
Did, yeah.
And so here you are. You're very well known in England, and you decide you're going to write this novel.
Mm-hmm.
And let me guess, you turned it in, but you didn't put your real name on it.
Yes, that is true. Yes,
because you wanted it to be for the story. You didn't want it to be about you, right?
Yes, and also because of that, whatever I've done, like I said, I wouldn't take a second of it back. I've had a wonderful time. But it does have a certain colour and flavour, and heaven knows what the book that people would expect an ex-Blue Peter presenter to write might be, but it probably isn't The Butcher's Hook. And I didn't want anyone getting any kind of preconceived notions, whether they were good or bad, about what might be inside the covers. So I chose, I never met either of my grandmothers, and I chose one of their names to take the book forward, because that seemed to be a nice way of introducing them into my life after all this time. And also because I thought Jo Winter, who is my mother's mother, has a sort of name where you can't quite tell who she is. You don't know whether she's a racy sort of a girl, or whether she's brilliant at maths, whether she's great at games, whether she wants to go exploring the world. It seemed to me she had all sorts of possibilities of colour and flavour in her name. And I love the fact, obviously I wouldn't want it to be published as anyone else but me, because I'm mighty proud to have done it. But I love the fact that just for a while, the book and Jo were out there on their own. It's a really huggable fact to me.
Mm. Janet Ellis joins us. Her novel is The Butcher's Hook, and it's set in Georgia and England. And for our listeners here in America, explain what that means. Was that the period prior to Queen Victoria?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's the time when, if I say it was quite a peaceful time in English history, I would imagine that, for everybody it wasn't exactly the same because communication was difficult. But basically there were no big battles being fought. There was no big plague. It was a time of quite calm religious feeling too. The Methodism was on the rise, but nobody particularly objected to people worshipping in different ways. And the new George III was on the throne, and people liked the fact that he was a full-blood Englishman. And it was before the madness of King George, so it was quite a calm time in the monarchy as well. And it was a time when people were beginning to explore the world. More people were living in towns than the countryside for the first time. So the towns, and this is set in London, were teeming with people. They were really busy. The great river Thames that flows through the middle of London, at times it was said you could walk from one bank to the other on the ships that were coming up, filled with all sorts of things that people were importing or people going hither and yon and exploring the world.
Mm-hmm.
So from what I imagined of it, the bit that I thought I could see, because there are still little bits of Georgian architecture, which is very beautiful, of course, dotted around in London. And the way I could imagine that it sort of tasted and smelt and might have felt were absolutely fascinating to me. And then I began to think about what it would be like to have been a young girl then, at a time when, if you come from a fairly well-to-do household, as my heroine Anne does, your path was going to be pretty much determined for you, wasn't it? You know, your father and mother were going to have decided who you were, what sort of man at least you were going to marry. And they wouldn't have given you much of an education because that wasn't fashionable then. So if you were a smart girl learning about the world, how would it feel if you then fell hook, line and sinker in your teens with the wrong boy? What would happen next? So it was that kind of germ of a seed of an idea that I really wanted to explore.
And she is 19. Her name is Anne Jacob. And she is very smart. She's fairly isolated. She's in this, I guess you'd say they're an affluent family. And they have a lot of servants. And her mother is kind of detached from her. Her mother's been having some difficulties with children, losing babies, and there's been a very tragic, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, there's been a very tragic death in the family of a young child. Yes. And this really impacts the story, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I think without necessarily, because I didn't plan out the book, you know, I had an idea, and it was more like holding her hand and seeing where we went. But I did need a reason for her mother, who's an important character in the book, even though she's quite in the background. But I needed her to be sort of absent and present at the same time, if you know what I mean. And I thought, if you are constantly trying to have the boy child, and obviously that was incredibly important, and you have a series of miscarriages and stillbirths, and eventually, yes, a son is born, but as you say, things don't work out well, that it would add to the claustrophobia of the household to have this woman, Anne's mother, not there for her and yet loving her, but unable to really reach out and hold her tight.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes. I'll continue my conversation with Janet Ellis right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. This morning I'm talking to Janet Ellis. She joined us by telephone from London, England, and we're talking about her debut novel, The Butcher's Hook. As the story progresses, I think that initially, as a reader, I felt very sympathetic towards Anne, and she falls madly in love with this apprentice to a butcher, and she's finding any way that she can to spend time with him, and his social class is much below hers. This is kind of a doomed relationship, but she really wants him, and she thinks he really wants her, and she's really driven by the fact that she's 19 years old, and she's passionate. It kind of blinds her to everything. And as the story goes on, we start worrying about her a little bit because she's kind of a I don't know if she's crazy, but she's kind of she's a scary. She gets pretty scary.
She's a bit of a loose cannon, isn't she?
Yeah. I don't want to give it. I don't want to give stuff away. She holds a grudge. Wouldn't you say she holds a grudge?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely, she does. Yes, yes, yes. It was quite. A lot of people have asked me, and you're absolutely right that there is this sort of driven by being a teenager, isn't it? That, you know, the force that we can all identify, and certainly the stuff I remember from being a teenager myself. But somebody the other day said to me, "How did you feel when you really started to write and everything was in place and you realized that it was going to, you know, for the first time you're going to finish a book and the story would be settled?" And I said, liberating, because that's really what it felt like. I felt as though I'd just been given the keys to a door. Nobody really knew what was the other side of it, but I was free to run or walk as I wanted and explore. And it was just the most heady feeling. As an actress, I've done quite a lot of improvisation. And I had the same sense of just seeing where it took me. And I think because I'm older and because although I'd been given in a sort of childish way permission to write, I still wasn't competing with a peer group. You know, I wasn't even sure, obviously, whether I'd be published. And I thought, I don't, now, at my age and this stage and with this girl's hand in mine, I don't really have to worry about what people think.
Mm.
And I can't tell you, that was just the best feeling. And seeing what Anne got up to and knowing that, although I wanted a logic for her, you know, as you say, she's a scary character, but in my head, speaking in her defense, I can give her a kind of crazy logic to what she does.
Mm-hmm.
There are several episodes that I wrote that I took out of the book because I thought, no, it kind of goes against that feeling. It goes against the kind of justification that she has, that although it is skewed in my head, she has a moral compass. It just isn't set to quite the true north that you or I might understand.
Yeah. Well, she wants what she wants, and
yeah.
She's a little paranoid, too, and her vision of the world, like all of us, her vision is her vision. And
yeah.
You know, she's in love with this guy, but maybe he doesn't see things quite the way that she does. And it's not a bodice ripper or anything like that. There's no pornography in this, but this is the most sexually charged book I think I've read in a long time.
Wow, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you've got that down. I mean, that's what she thinks about.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Yeah.
But it's that driver, isn't it? When you're in your teens, when you fall in love for the first time, the other person almost doesn't matter. It's such a subjective emotion,
uh-huh.
And all those things you're feeling that you think no one else in the whole world has ever felt before, they're directed at the person, but they're fired up by you, and the other person kind of shifts a little, don't they, in your field of vision, you know, according to how you're feeling that day.
Mm.
You know, the poor them, they're almost irrelevant for a while as you feel this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the most powerful and extraordinary and utterly selfish way of feeling. Because, of course, when you're in love for the first time when you're young, you don't have to worry about, you know, how your kids are going to react or how your friends are going to react. And certainly for somebody like Anne, who lives in this very claustrophobic world, she doesn't have connection with a peer group. You know, along the way, she's tried to make friends. That doesn't go right for her either. But she doesn't take from that, and this, I sort of envy her, really. She doesn't ever think it's her fault.
Uh-huh.
She has all the attributes of the narcissist. In fact, weirdly enough, a friend of mine who is a psychotherapist read the book after it was published and rang me up really excitedly and said, you know, I'm actually, you know, if she wasn't a fictitious character, I would use her as a case study because she just has narcissism really clearly. So without necessarily knowing it, at least I stayed true to all the tropes of narcissism and kept Anne well within the rather elastic boundaries.
Mm. Janet Ellis joins us by telephone from London, England. The book is The Butcher's Hook. It's her first novel and quite a read. And, okay, let's talk about this love interest of hers. He's a great character. Tell us who he is.
Fub, the butcher's boy.
Uh-huh.
And I have to make a confession here, Vic, because I like doing research, but I'm not one of those writers who researches to such an extent that I have to tear myself away. You know, I chose the year, 1763, really carefully because nothing really happened in 1763 in London. You know, I didn't want my characters being busy with their intense and terrible lives only to have a load of people say to me, well, nobody seems to mention the big battle.
Mm.
Because I was too busy putting them, they're the most colourful things. You know, the year is the backdrop to what they're doing. But I didn't know anything. Well, the minute I typed the sentence, you know, there stood the butcher's boy, I thought, why have I done that to myself? I don't know anything about being a butcher.
Uh-huh.
Well, butcher's habits now, not least now, certainly not in 1763. So I got in touch with the Worshipful Company of Butchers, you know, which is the old guild of butchers,
mm-hmm.
in the East End of London. And I said to them, you know, I've got loads of questions about how it happened. You know, what did they do? And whoever I was speaking to said very carefully, well, I don't really know either, but you're welcome to come and have a look in our library. So I spent some time in their library, and it's not brilliantly curated. I've told them this. It's fascinating, but it's not all in neat little sections.
Mm-hmm.
So I found a lot of things I didn't know I was looking for, which was too good to leave out. And some of the questions I thought I needed the answer to, I didn't necessarily find the absolute and accurate answer. But I'm yet to be called on this, because when I was writing what they do, you know, I described the slaughter of a calf and other things that were part of the trade of being a butcher. And I kind of made it up. I mean, I used other sources. It hasn't changed very much over the years. My own local butcher will attest to that. But it was most important to me that he was somebody who already dealt in the ways of the flesh. I think that was probably the driving force.
Mm. I love the way you set up your title, and readers will have to read the novel, The Butcher's Hook, to see where they get hooked on that particular title. It's it's clever how you do that. And her father is trying to get her into an arranged marriage, so to speak, and her suitor, I think, is the most repulsive person I've read about in quite a while. He's grotesque.
I did have a lot of fun with Mr. Onions, I have to say. Yeah, if anybody wants to think he's based on somebody specific, they're welcome, but I think he's definitely a composite. And he's one of those wonderful people, I think this is why I enjoyed him so much, who just have such an overweening and overwhelming vanity that they are impervious to either criticism or the wants or needs of others. He just thinks he's the best at absolutely everything. And he's very manipulative, and he's not a kind person at all. I think away from books and writing, the quality I look for first and foremost in people, alongside a good sense of humour, is kindness. And Sebastian Onions has none. Shimeon, he has none. So it's a very odd thing that I enjoyed writing him so much. It's obviously going over to the dark side, really, uh-huh. and finding in him qualities which were the absolute opposite of anything I think are attractive, but still finding him very enjoyable.
I read a lot of novels, and I almost always will find a fairly peripheral character who is a favorite. And in your book, you have a very peripheral character who only shows up once or twice, and he's very kind, and he's the Scotsman. And I loved I loved how you let us see him again at the end.
Oh, thank you for that. I think it probably comes. Obviously, I'm fascinated by the crossovers, and there are a lot of novelists who've started as actors. And I think one of the crossovers is that if you are working in the theatre or in a film, and you are playing somebody who is not the star of the show, you kind of still think your character is. The famous thing about somebody saying, "Oh, it's a play about a maid who comes on in the third act and says dinner is served." In other words, I'd hate to give any of the characters who ever appear in anything I write less than their due, because they are important. And you could, if you'd needed to, write the whole book about them. But I'm very thrilled that you chose him, because I do have a very soft spot for him. He's kind of the one who gets her, isn't he? He sees her very clearly when nobody else does.
And as Americans, we're not aware of the history there and the fact that he's very much persona non grata on the streets of London, walking around in his kilt.
Yes, his illegal kilt, yeah.
Yeah.
They were banned. This was after the Jacobite Rebellion, which was some 20 years earlier, when the English did not behave very well. And the Scots were dispossessed, you know, sort of denied their lands and titles, and were forced to, as soldiers, to sort of give up the world, really, and beg on the streets. And they weren't supposed to wear their kilts at all with their family tartan. But, he does, and it doesn't serve him very well.
And Jacob's mother is almost like a wraith in this story. She's almost ghost-like. She's not well. She's up in her room, isolated most of the time. And her father, he doesn't come off too well at the start. We think, oh, what a horrible character. But I think by the end of the story, I at least started to kind of like him a little bit. I started to kind of relate to him. I don't know why.
Did you? Yeah, I love that. That's great. I think they deserve their place. You know, they've had tough times too. And in those days when you weren't really in touch with the world to find out if anything you were thinking or doing was normal, even for somebody like Anne's father, who could go about and, you know, clap somebody else heartily on the back and have manly chats about things, their feelings weren't discussed, you know, and all those lost children or possibility of children must have affected him too. And I think when he comes up against his own daughter's combative nature, he is at a complete loss. You know, he hasn't coped terribly well with his wife's surgeons in bed or the loss of all the children. He can't really celebrate the child. Right at the beginning of the book, there's the birth of a baby sister for Anne, and nobody in the house really can get involved with this child. The mother is obviously terrified she'll lose her. For Anne, she's no replacement for the adored baby brother she lost. And for Anne's father, it means just another mouth to feed and someone else to marry off in the future. Mm. So I think you're right to feel some sympathy for him, really, because I don't think anyone's all bad. You know, at least I've yet to meet anyone truly horribly evil in the course of their domestic doings. He's not a great character. He's certainly not the father who could rein Anne in. But he probably doesn't mean any of that stuff, does he, really?
Yeah. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. And it's my pleasure to have Janet Ellis on the program today. Her novel is The Butcher's Hook. And you write with great humor. It's very subtle. But I love the way you write. And I also was struck by the fact that this is one of the darkest stories I've read in a long time. It almost reads like a horror novel. Don't you think, a little bit? It's pretty, pretty horrific.
Of sort of grand guignol in what happens to people. But I have to say, I am smiling here like anything. I'm just so thrilled that you found humor in it, because that's really important to me. That's how we leaven life, isn't it? You know, with everything that's going on at the moment, you have to find that side of it. And I don't know how people exist in the world if they can't ever so slightly look at it through a wry prism and make sense of it like that, however terrible things are. So I'm absolutely thrilled you found that. But what? Yes, with the sort of the horror of it, I'm always struck by the closeness we have to the prosaic. You know, when people are describing something awful that happens in their neighborhood, the first thing they say is usually, well, things like that don't happen here. Mm. And of course they do. Or they say, but you know, but he was always, or she was always, you know, unless it's somebody absolutely appalling, but they go, you'd never have suspected that of them because, you know, they looked so ordinary or they seemed so nice. And I thought, it's that, isn't it? It's that whisper, you know, cigarette paper slimness between the actions of the good person and the bad person and how often they are two sides of the same coin. I always find that utterly fascinating. When I was younger, I read a lot of true life murder accounts. I had a period in my late teens of finding that deeply fascinating. You can see where that ended up going. But it is just finding, you know, you can't tell. When you sit across a train carriage from somebody, you can't tell the thoughts in their head. They might be brilliant, they might be terrible. And I find that utterly riveting.
Mm, the Moore's murders, yes.
Yes. Oh, my yes. God, have you read that book, the Emlyn Hughes, I want to say, Beyond Belief?
Yes, I'm familiar with it.
Again, it is that, isn't it? How it was just next door, down the road, up the street from you, all the time.
Oh, my.
And I read the, I can't remember the writer of the best account of the Boston Strangler, which, again, is full of the most prosaic details.
Uh-huh.
I still want people to sleep soundly in their beds, but I'm fascinated by the possibility of that all the time.
Well, it's really been a pleasure, and I hope that you have another book in you, because I would want to read it.
I've just given my just waiting for my editor's notes on book two.
Wonderful. And I want to congratulate you on being made a member of the most excellent order of the British Empire by the Queen Elizabeth.
Thank you. Oh, that's so nice. It was, I have to say, a complete and utter shock and one of the nicest things that happened. and just a brilliant family day when I went up to Buckingham Palace and Prince William handed me my MBE. One of those things that of all the things, and there have been several amazing things that have happened to me in my life, where you just think, it is that doorway again. I stepped through a doorway into another world for a while, and gosh, it's quite hard to come back.
Well, Janet, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to a contemporary. You are 9 days younger than me.
Are you another Virgo?
Yes, we're Virgos.
Yeah, wow.
Thank you, Janet.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Vic.
My guest has been Janet Ellis. Her novel is The Butcher's Hook. And it really was a pleasure to talk to Janet Ellis about her debut novel, The Butcher's Hook. And we have a little extra time on the program this morning. And I'd like for you to experience the way that she writes. I'm going to read you a brief excerpt from The Butcher's Hook. And this talks about an area where Anne has gone to a church and she's looking for the priest. And she approaches the church. Here we go. Their numbers thin as I approach the church, and by the time I tread the path to the door, I am alone. The huge, heavy door is only slightly ajar, and it's quite a struggle to push it further. A smell of wax, incense, dust, and something floral is so thick in the air it's almost visible. Not so any other person, for my footsteps sound loudly on the floor, and even my skirt's swish is distinctly audible. There are no candles lit, doubtless to save money, for even though it is morning and daylight outside, within is fusty darkness and shadows. When one of these shadows becomes solid and speaks, I jump with alarm. Ah, I startled you. I am sorry. The man in front of me is tall, dressed all in brown, but with a priest's white collar at his neck. I do not recognize him. In the time since that last most miserable attendance, my brother's funeral, the keeper of the parish must have changed. He has been sitting on a nearby pew, but he was not praying there unless it was to say grace. He has a large slice of cake in his hands. It is hard to manage, and he cannot keep it in one piece. It splits softly in two. Cupping one hand beneath the other, he attempts to catch the crumbs, but the thing disintegrates with great speed, with most of it failing to reach his open mouth despite him lifting his hands up to get it there. "Please finish your meal," I tell him, wishing I was still 5 minutes down the road and he could stuff his snack into his face without an audience. I gesture to the seats beside me. "I will sit, or rather kneel, here for a minute." I hope I am making the face of someone who genuinely wishes to do this. He nods in agreement, and I assume a position of piety and try to ignore the noise of mastication from behind me. I have no prayer to offer up, for even if I believed in a helpful God, I would surely be trying his patience with my list of needs. Perhaps I should petition for my mother, that her health be restored and her strength renewed, that she might take up her full place in the house. For her greatest happiness, though, I suspect my father must die and leave her a widow. But to ask for that in this place would be more like witchcraft than religion. I look up at the vaulted ceiling. Come, then, I think. Punish my wicked thoughts. But no lightning strikes. The pale stone is blank. Of course, I reason. This is because I have right on my side, and any such deity, their salt, would approve of my request and act on my behalf. Perhaps, when I get home, there will be only a smoldering pile of ash where my father stood. A large pile, as he might as well burn onions, too, while he's at it. And she's referring to onions, the man her father wants her to marry. We continue. A little cough behind me, and I remember the vicar is there. I stay kneeling a moment longer, as though I am finishing off an especially lengthy prayer. Then I get to my feet. Edging to the aisle, I put my hand out to the polished wooden orb at the pew end. The vicar mistakes this for a greeting and takes my hand, so that I am pulled towards him while stuck by my skirts in the row of seats. His hand still has crumbs on it. Several more garland his neck piece. I pull my hand back. He pats at his unwigged hair with his messy hand. The man will be so covered in foodstuff as to be almost edible himself by nightfall. He waits awkwardly while I wriggle free. "There," I say. Then I extend my hand to cheer him up. He looks perplexed by all this social difficulty. He takes my hand gingerly, lest more awkwardness prevail. "Mistress Jacob, from Thomas Jacob's house," I say. He puts his head on one side like a bird. "Ah, yes," there is a question in his voice. Surely he knows my father. We might not be often in this place, but we are a long time in the parish. "We are at Castle Street." "Of course," he makes little soft fists of his hands and rubs his fingertips where the crumbs still stick and chafe. "Shall we go to my study?" He indicates the door behind me, but then squeezes past to lead the way. It seems he must do everything in the most uncomfortable way. He goes to the little side door, then holds it for me to go in. It is a narrow entrance again, and quite hard to get my wide dress through. I cannot think of any conversation to fill the moment, so hold my breath as I maneuver myself. He says nothing, either. Inside the small room, there is a table with a lone chair behind it, which must serve as his desk. There are only a few books on top, along with a large solid Bible and the rest of the cake. It sits resplendent on white paper. We both regard it solemnly. "The kindness of some parishioners," he points at the cake. It is a great doorstop of a thing, and although he took a considerable slice, there is plenty left. "Oh, would you?" A vague opening of his hands. "I am not hungry, thank you. Nor do I want to maneuver any of the cake. I have witnessed how hard it is to consume it at all daintily." He sits behind the table, then jumps up again as he realizes I am still upright. "Forgive me, Miss Jacob. I don't seem to have had many visitors of late. I am out of the habit of entertaining." He looks disconsolate, then casts about for a chair. "I can stand here," I begin, but he is out of the door again, saying, "Ah," as he goes, then returning with a little folded stool. "I had to stand on this to retrieve a dead bird," he says, as he straightens the thing out. A print of his shoe is clearly visible on the flat surface. "Ah," he says again, then rubs at it with one sleeve. "Ah," he says sadly, for the shape is still there despite his cleaning. But nothing else can be done, and we must proceed. My stool is much lower than the chair he sits on, so I have to peer at him over the edge of the table. "I confess that I have not yet made acquaintance with your household," he looks down at me as he might from the pulpit. "I am quite new in this parish, of course. My predecessor, unfortunately, died not long ago." I would have thought dying was the highest achievement of any priest, putting him at last in the vicinity of the unseen realm that he had spoken of at such length. "He has not left me very busy, Miss Jacob. Not a very, substantial flock. Hence I am not much called on, I rather think," he leans forward, "that there might have been a great exodus here to, the Methodists." And that is an excerpt from The Butcher's Hook by Janet Ellis. And don't touch that dial. We've got a little Book Nook bonus coming up for you right after this. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Good morning. I am Vic McCunis, and this is the Book Nook. And today we had Janet Ellis on the program. She joined us by telephone from London, England. And she apparently loves public radio because she footed the bill for that phone call from London. She called us, and we do appreciate that, Janet. And we really appreciate folks who understand the value of public radio stations like this one. And I have Book Nook bonus for you this morning. Tracy Chevalier was on the program last year for her novel, At the Edge of the Orchard. And that book opens in the Great Black Swamp in northern Ohio. The book just came out in paperback, and we're going to revisit a portion of that interview with Tracy Chevalier as we close out the Book Nook. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm delighted to welcome back to the program today Tracy Chevalier. Hello, Tracy.
Hi, it's good to be back.
Wow, Tracy, what a story. At the Edge of the Orchard, it's apples and Ohio and swamps. And tell us how you got the idea for this.
Well, I was I had it in my mind that I wanted to write a book about trees. Because trees mean a lot to me. They mean a lot to everybody. I think we have a really strong emotional connection to them, especially in childhood. I can remember really well all the trees that I climbed. And then I was, my last book, The Last Runaway, was also set in Ohio. And when I was researching that book, I read a book by Michael Pollan called The Botany of Desire.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a section in it, it's about our relationship to plants, and there's a section in it about apples. And Pollan follows in the footsteps of Johnny Appleseed all over Ohio. And in it, he kind of debunks the myth of Johnny Appleseed as being this sort of promoter of healthy living through apples. What he points out is that actually the apples, first of all, Johnny Appleseed, John Chapman, his real name was a businessman, and he made money off of selling apple trees. He didn't give them away. And he usually, what he'd do is anticipate where settlers were going to go in Ohio and go there a few years before them and plant a nursery, of which there are still remains here and there in Ohio, as you probably know. And and then when the settlers would get there, he would sell them trees, the apple trees, for their orchards they needed to grow. And but these trees didn't actually produce sweet apples for eating. They were primarily sour apples for making cider and applejack with. So it wasn't about promoting healthy eating. It was more like, here's some alcohol. Here's how you can make alcohol to get through this difficult settler life. And I found that contradiction between the myth and the reality really fascinating, and it gave me this idea of this couple fighting over apples, him wanting to do to grow sweet apples to eat, and she wanting to grow sour apples to make into applejack. So the idea came out of there, and I wanted to set it, I knew, in the 1830s, and Johnny Appleseed spent a lot of time up in the Black Swamp, and so that's why I set it there. It was the last area of Ohio to be settled in northwest Ohio, just south of Toledo, because it was such an awful place to live. Nobody wanted to be there, so that was the land that was still available to this family that I created, and that's where they ended up.
Therefore, Johnny Appleseed, John Chapman, was an entrepreneur, and he was filling the needs for these early settlers for lots of alcohol to anesthetize from these horrible conditions, the feelings that they had. And this woman, Sadie, she liked her spitters, didn't she? This was the good enough family. Tell us about this family, and then tell us about the Black Swamp. What a place.
Yeah. The Goodenoughs, the husband and wife are James and Sadie Goodenough, and they come from Connecticut to settle in Ohio, and they end up settling in the Black Swamp because, first of all, the rest of Ohio has more or less been settled. They hadn't realized that when they got there, so they kept going west to see if they could find some land, and they said, somebody said, go to the Maumee River, and they're going along there, and they ended up getting stuck, and that's why, in the mud, that's pretty much why they landed in the Black Swamp. There was this famous road that people would go along, and the mud was so bad that they'd only get about half a mile before they'd have to scrape off the mud from the wheels of the wagon, and the horses sometimes broke their legs in the mud. It was that bad. And the Goodenoughs end up stuck there, so they think, all right, we'll stay. And they make a claim on land, and one of the requirements of claiming land at that time was that you had to grow an orchard of 50 trees, and within 3 years. So that's what they try to carve out this orchard out of this terrible Black Swamp. I had a wonderful time with research. There isn't much left of the Black Swamp now. As you can imagine, it was drained eventually, and it's all been built on. So there are only little nature reserves here and there that preserve remnants of it. But there's some wonderful tales and stories about the Black Swamp that have been collected by a man named Jim Mollenkopf in three volumes of Tales of the Black Swamp, and it's based on people's letters and reminiscences of their time living there. And there were some wonderful details, like apparently everybody got what was called swamp fever between August and October. It probably was malaria, and there were swarms of mosquitoes. The mosquitoes were so bad that they had to wear mittens and in August and burn smudge pots all the time, and still they got all bitten up, and then they'd get the swamp fever, and their teeth would chatter so loudly they'd sort of joke about the neighbors a mile away being able to hear, and it sounded just awful. In the mud, there's another detail in one of these accounts that when they take off their trousers at the end of the day, they put them in the corner of the cabin, and they would dry overnight standing up because there's so much mud on them. So I loved all of those details and tried to include them as much as I could. And so the Goodenoughs moved to the Black Swamp. They have 10 children, but 5 of them die of swamp fever and other things. And it's a really hard life, and the couple, James and Sadie, are mismatched. They probably never should have married, but these circumstances make their life, the feud that develops between them, even more intense.
And Sadie is very unhappy about everything, about living in this horrible place, about not having enough Applejack to drink. They fight over apples. In fact, apples are the big issue between them. James loves his apples, but he wants the sweet ones. He wants the Pippins. He wants the good eating apples. And she wants the spitters. She wants the ones to be made into Applejack. And when she drinks, she gets nasty. And I had the pleasure. I knew there were so many voices in this book. I thought, I'm going to listen to the audiobook version.
I haven't heard it yet.
Woman who does Sadie is fabulous.
It's a great part. It's interesting because most of the book is actually told in third person, although there are some letters as well in first person. But Sadie kind of came out of me just as herself. She's such a strong character that I had to let her tell the story in her own voice. So she has a very distinctive voice, and she is incredibly unpleasant and cruel. But I hope that the reader can also find some small measure of sympathy for her, because she's clearly married the wrong man. She's stuck in this swamp in terrible circumstances, and she's one of those people who needs a lot of attention. And, you know, the right kind of attention, she would have turned out all right, but she doesn't get the right kind of attention. Her husband spends a lot of time with his apple trees, and she's not too happy about that, and just not too happy about a lot of things. And I'm sorry to say she's also a terrible mother. And the book, in a way, is about a dysfunctional family and the effect of this feuding that escalates out of control, and how that affects the children, the Goodenough children, so that the book eventually leaps forward 15, 20 years to California, where their youngest child, Robert, has fled, leaving this sort of violent family behind. He's made his way slowly over 15 years across the states to see if he can find some sort of peace anywhere, and it seems like he finds it in California for a while anyway.
And that was a Book Nook bonus for you this morning. Tracy Chevalier talking about her most recent novel, At the Edge of the Orchard, which just came out in paperback. And the book opens in an area called the Great Black Swamp in northern Ohio. And it's very much a book about apples. And we revisited that interview as our special treat for you this morning to close out the program. And we began with The Butcher's Hook, Janet Ellis, speaking to us by telephone from London, England. And I highly recommend that novel, set in Georgian England. That's the period under George III, just prior to the long reign of Queen Victoria of England. And make sure you tune in for the Book Nook tomorrow morning at 10:30. We have a first-time interview coming your way, the first radio interview by Lara Elena Donnelly. And her book, Amberlow, just came out this past week. and we recorded an interview with her on the publication date. It was all very exciting because she grew up right here in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And I have memories of her as a grade schooler, and I knew she was very interested in writing. And after all these years, her first novel has just come out, and it's all very exciting to share with Lara on her first radio interview, which we recorded earlier this week. And we'll bring that to you tomorrow, along with information on her book tour. She is coming through the area. She'll have a book signing in Dayton, another one in Yellow Springs, and a couple in Kentucky. And Amber Lowe is quite a debut novel. Lara is 26 years old. She'll be 27 next month. And it was really a treat to have her on the program because she's a longtime listener. She grew up listening to the Book Nook, and maybe she was making it up, but she told me that she'd always dreamed of being on the program. So we're going to share that dream with you tomorrow in the Book Nook at 10:30, right here on WYSO. Thanks for listening.